When we, in our everyday life, no matter what kind of activities we engage in, our attitude of openness and inclusiveness is essential. It's essential for us. And in doing that, we are truly acknowledging others. If we're in the health care, if our job is that, or working with dying, it's absolutely essential. Whether a person who we deal with is disrespectful of us, is angry, if we are clear in our own minds that what's happening was not set up by us, then what is there to take personally? We need to learn to honor the space other people are in, honor it in our own minds. It is their path. If we don't put up resistance, if we don't reflect back to them what they're doing, then they have a better chance of seeing themselves clearly.
When you say if we don't reflect back to them,
react.
React, thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, always ask. In opening to living and dying without defending ourselves, we liberate a tremendous amount of energy. Remember yesterday I was talking about constriction. When we let go of our reference points, we open ourselves to a new way of being and perceiving. And letting go of reference points is what moment by moment continually defines us to ourselves. So the words are easy to say, but man, do we ever have to be mindful to catch ourselves. And it can be unnerving, frightening, joyful, because we're letting go of everything that we use to identify who we are. When we have a moment of presence, or Maslow a long time ago called it a peak experience, why don't we just stay there? Why? I mean, the moment when it first arises, is full and joyful. And then what pops up?
Sometimes it just erodes slowly. Sometimes particular thoughts come in that you can see it, cause it to erode, other things.
Well, in that state, I think what comes up is a tinge of fear because we don't know, we can't find ourselves. There's no I. And it's like having the rug pulled out from under ourselves. And each time we have that experience, we set up the habit of immediately walking away from it, and which is only by following a thought. You have a question? You have that.
Thank you for asking. This morning when I woke up, after I stood up, I felt a peak experience, and it was how grateful I was am to be here, and I felt a very deep sense of gratitude to everyone who's here, and I cried because it was very strong, and it was amazing and wonderful to feel exactly that and recognize in that way that is so completely recognizing something in my whole being that each person here, oh yeah, yeah, we're all seeking together. Oh yeah, 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 that's why we're here, we're all seeking together. And such a sense of wanting to thank each person here for that, being here to do that. And I know that I understand Buddhism to be a place where it's okay to debate. And so I just was kind of going, well, but I didn't go away from that moment, right? I mean, I didn't immediately. So it was a sense of how complete that was for me. And yes, when you started, it's like, why didn't I stay in that moment? I mean, yes, indeed, I am not in that moment. And yet I felt such a sense of maybe being more in that moment than some moments that I allowed, that I didn't go away from faster. And at least, I guess, I just didn't feel a sense of resistance to it. I felt such an openness to it. That's all.
Do you know what contributes to feeling that moment? Gratitude. I mean, gratitude isn't something we can hang our hat on. It's kind of amorphous. And that will carry us through those moments more than anything else.
Yeah, I noticed that too when you were talking, that thinking about experiences of mine similar, you know, really peak experiences, if you would, they often have a gratitude for something, or what Christians would call grace, you know, really. Mm-hmm. That's how it feels, yeah.
I feel grateful to have the gratitude.
Yeah.
Well, I always find in those moments also such a feeling of homecoming. There's a homeness about it. Oh, I'm back. And I mean, more so than any place or home I ever had. And deep down more familiar. And that in itself is what, for me, brings tears. And it is there. And it's not out there. It's in here. Gratitude. I was going to bring up that word this morning. Thank you.
I have a question to follow up on what Laura just said. So, you know, obviously that was emotionally a very moving experience for you. What would it be like, or could you sustain that emotion? I for one just can't conceive of being at that sort of emotional peak for ever, you know, for the duration. So, you know, I like this idea of gratitude because, you know, you had brought up the idea of fear when we're in those moments, you know, this fear of like no self or, you know, yeah. And, you know, thinking, okay, so what's the antidote to that fear? And maybe, you know, I'll try on gratitude as an answer for that. But, boy, I just don't know, you know. Are there people who live at that emotional peak all the time? I don't know.
You know, in all of these years, watching the lamas, mm-hmm. and Dejun Rinpoche was the first, because he was always doing Chenrezig Mantra. And I would ask him about it through a translator, and he would say, if you're in human body, you're prey to the foibles.
In human body,
doesn't matter who you are, you're prey to the foibles. The five poisons or the three poisons. So here's a great, great, great lama who asleep, awake, when he isn't teaching, or while Sonam is translating, and he's saying that the mantra starts going again. That's mindfulness. And slipped away in a moment. It's not, being mindful isn't difficult. It's just our habit is to follow our thoughts. I mean, we've been trained from birth. I've watched the lamas through all of these years, and if they have to deal with something relative, airline tickets, logistics of something, I watch them bring in their mind to deal with, this is in response to what you said, to deal with everyday things. And then when that's finished, see, things don't finish for us. We carry it. Their mind just naturally expands back out. It's emotional now when we have the experience, because it's such a opposite to our everyday life. But the more we become familiar with it, it's just functioning on a whole different level. Their natural state, mine is expanded. Ours is contracted. And if you stop to think about it, like what I said yesterday, if we follow a thought, some part of our body tenses up. It can be a shoulder, it can be a toe, it can be a finger. But there is physical effort to follow a thought. So part of the relief and the gratitude of that moment is the burden is absolutely laid down when we have a peak experience. And we cannot make that experience happen. But the more open we are, the more gratitude, the more love, whatever, the experience is there waiting to arise. We're the ones who walk away. It's always there. Isn't it amazing when you stop to think, we go through our daily life like a horse with blinders on, taking a great deal of effort to maintain that, but that's what's familiar, and we're waiting for a peak experience. Whereas, metaphorically, if we took the blinders off, the peak experience is already there. We could not even conceive of enlightenment if it were not already in essence who we are. We could not conceive of it. It would be beyond any comprehension. And one of the advantages I've seen with myself and with other Dharma practitioners is as we get older, the things that were so important when we were young, like the size of my foot, I have a size 13. That didn't go over well in the 50s. We let go of all those things that were embarrassing or upset us. It isn't worth our time. And so there's a freedom that starts coming. But for a non-practitioner, when my oldest sister, she was 14 years older than me, died, or previous to dying, she had a lot of unresolved stuff. She was not always seeking outside of herself, and lived her life around everything that was stuffed down inside. And then she had in essence, a stroke. And all that stuff that she had held down, all the vulnerabilities and upsets, manifested fully. And I had never really seen that before. But she didn't have the strength to keep it hidden down. And I found myself saying with the time I was spending with her, man, I don't want to face beyond my deathbed with the words, I wish I had. I wish I had practiced more. I wish I had dealt with my issues. I wish. And each moment, each second, just like we're choosing samsara over enlightenment moment by moment, we're choosing to carry burdens rather than not carry burdens. We're choosing what is familiar even if it's not comfortable. We don't even think about it. We don't even know we have a choice. We don't even know we have a choice. And when you realize that, you've already started in motion that mindful awareness that begins catching you up so you can make different choices. It starts on big things, but you start not moving blindly. How often, it can be anything. You're going to start doing exercise, you're going to go on a diet, or you're going to finish the tasks around the house you haven't done. Say we're on a diet and you know there's something in the kitchen you would like, but no, you aren't going to go get it. And then 5 minutes later, you find yourself eating it, but you don't remember the point at which you got up and went and got it. Or you were determined to do tasks and 5 minutes later, you find yourself laying on the couch reading a book. We shut down everything to follow our whims. We're a puppet to this relative mind. We aren't using it to our advantage. We let it pull the strings. And that's not the purpose of it at all. How are we going to move towards realizing the full potential of our being if we don't start taking control? How does one do that? Start being aware of what's around you, what's happening. Feel through your senses. Awareness in the physical body, pure awareness in the physical body comes out as the senses. So that's one of the avenues back. And that's something each one of us can do. If we're walking from point A to point B, feel the foot walking. If you pay, think about your hand and move it. If you really feel it moving through the air, it's a sensual feeling. Some of you do yoga or the, where are those two girls who were at breakfast? The ones who were new?
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe doing yoga.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that.
We have the tools here, not here. This isn't going to get you anywhere.
What if where does pain come in there? Because in a way for me, I feel I don't know that when you say, you know, control of your mind, for me it feels, what would be helpful is more control of my feelings. So, I mean, you know, there's like the senses, but then I don't know where it fits in there, but the feeling, like the emotional feeling.
Felt perception?
Well,
I think we're having a semantic problem. I think we're saying the same thing. I'm saying we give over, for the most part, we give over control to hear. And so the sensations of the heart, the senses, all of that is really our doorway, not our intellectual brain.
So if my heart, I'm feeling pain in my heart.
Sadness, pain?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm very aware of it in the present moment, or just very aware of it. And maybe there's also story, backstory about it, being in it. I guess I'm, well, it's a question, it's also a kind of a mute, like going, answering my own question of, so is that a construct of my mind that I'm not hearing or using?
The story's blocking it. I mean, if somebody close to us dies, some of the first feelings are, we grieve. But for a lot of people, at some point, it turns into a story, and the story is about them, not the person who died. What am I going to do? And at that point, and we do that almost, we have the initial, we see a beautiful sunrise, and we feel the opening with it, and then, oh my heavens, I have to tell Joe, or I have to tell Mary, and we step away from it to create a story about it. Why can't we just stay with the feeling? The stories. Well, wait, here. It's possible to apparently practice the Buddha Dharma for years without actually genuinely engaging. One of the ways in which we seek to deal with our suffering is dissociation and the creation of a pseudo-personality, which runs along with the original ego, pain body. Needless to say, nothing will come of that other than more conflict and pain. And we need to start at the very beginning. What is our condition right now? And this pseudo-personality, this story about me, creates a pseudo refuge, and we can convince ourselves of anything. We to ourselves are the most gullible person in the world, because we tell ourselves what we want to hear. And the mind, relative mind, especially statements and how we talk to ourselves, doesn't analyze what we say to ourselves. It just takes what we say as true. I remember what I mean. It was when I first came in to Dharma in the late 70s. Every time I sat down to practice, it was like there was a wall in my mind. And I went on for about 6 months, and I kept trying to go around it, over it, under it. And I think I finally just got exhausted, and it popped in my mind a statement I had made to myself. And I realized that that was the wall. And then the wall disappeared. But the experience of it was absolutely 100% solid. Watch the messages we give ourselves. And if we really, really, really learn to do that, then the messages we give to others will always be appropriate, because they'll flow from an authentic being. I wanted to clarify something to you from yesterday, and I didn't mention it. None of the really challenging stuff with Rinpoche came about until one time we were at Maratika and I was cooking for him. It's a holy cave of Guru Rinpoche. And I took, he was on retreat, and I took down his food one morning, and I found the words popping out of me, whatever you have to do in this life to help me realize the full potential of my being, I give you absolute permission. And his face didn't move, he didn't say anything, but I saw this smile come on his face, and I heard him say, in my mind, "Oh, Martha, you don't know what you're saying."
I don't know what you're asking.
And that night, when I took down a supper, I said, "Rinpoche, you know, this morning when I said yada, yada, yada?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You didn't say anything and your face didn't move, but this is what I saw and this is what I heard." "So you think you can read my mind now?" And that's after that point. Because at some point, whoever we take on as a teacher, we need to give them permission. Because that, I didn't know that, but that was the point I opened up. And that was the point that if I said, "Isn't it a beautiful blue sky?" he would say, "It's got a greenish color." It didn't matter what I said. Until finally, the poking, or challenging me on my stuttering, it ceased to be embarrassing. I didn't have a reaction anymore.
I'm still struggling a little bit with that. It's just, I'd say, and it feels a little bit like the coaches I've had who say, you know, "I'm going to lean on you so that you can be better," or the music instructors out there who are really hard on their students. And I just am still wondering about that, and if there are another path to, that are somehow kinder. I understand what you're saying on one level. And on another level, I'm still thinking isn't there another way to help that doesn't have necessarily that same quality or tone or something? Please, this isn't about doubting the motivation.
No. I'm not taking it personally.
Yeah.
I don't know how ingrained we are in our obscurations. Mm-hmm. How, I don't know. It's not that it has to be that way for everybody. And the challenge is how a teacher will challenge a student comes in all different ways depending on who the student is.
Yeah, I thought about that last night a little bit. I was thinking, okay, that might not work. Maybe it worked for you, it would probably work for me, and probably a good teacher would be able to figure that out.
I'm having something bubbling up. And I want to chime in here if I can. I think when Rinpoche was poking you, particularly about your stuttering, I don't think that he viewed you as less.
Oh no, not at all.
He saw your full Buddhahood, but you were the one that had the judgment about the stuttering. So in the case with the coaches, I don't think they have such big compassion. And I think when they push a player, they are seeing you as not a perfect player. So I think there's a really different dynamic, because I've had teachers that have said things to me that to other people would sound very harsh, and they were harsh. They were rattling my cage. because I had built that cage.
Right.
But the teachers themselves saw me being free of the cage.
Right. So and they knew it was absolutely possible.
But when people are, you know, I've also had abusive relationships, I'll be honest about that, where people were saying things to me with the intent of causing harm. And that is a different dynamic because they're not seeing your behavior as, you know, perfect or beautiful.
Right.
They're not seeing your Buddhahood. They're seeing you're doing something that I don't like.
Right.
And in a coach perspective, they want you to win. I mean, they do. The whole goal of sports and being a coach, if you're a good coach, you have a winning team. So I don't know that you could bring that same view of everyone as a bodhisattva to coaching. It's such a different dynamic.
Yeah, I hear that. There are some coaches who are really loving people and teachers who are really loving people too. And I understand what you're saying, that they are not by virtue of, you know, but so, in, okay, I can still work with this. It's okay. I actually have another question.
Okay.
Can I just say one teeny thing?
Yeah.
I just wondered if there might be a difference because you were so clear that you were giving permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you maybe were vulnerable because maybe didn't give permission, maybe, and then maybe as a younger spirit, you, it was being imposed on you, and it's just not.
So my other question, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate this, but it's about having to do something as opposed to simply being. So you have encouraged us to do some things in order to really be, but it's still a set of things to do. Feel our senses, feel our sensory, you know, be aware of our senses.
No, it's not be aware of your senses, it's experience. That's a whole different thing.
So, but isn't it still, when you said the word experience, it still feels to me like it's asking us to engage in something. Dropping the mind. Yeah, drop the mind. I've heard a number of teachers say drop the mind. Let me try this from a different angle. Every religious tradition I know, and in this sense, I think of Buddhism as a religious tradition, says, here's what you got to do. You're not perfect the way you are. Here's what you got to do. You've got this thing, original sin. You got this thing over here. You got to do something. Even putting yourself in some condition of some other condition is a request that you do something other than be. Am I making any sense at all to you?
Yeah, but, God, I challenge so many of my students who say that after I say something. Yeah, but, excuse me, I'm sorry. The one thing, if we allow for the possibility, the one thing we have going for us is there is nothing lacking in us at all. And if you allow for the possibility that that is true, then becoming cognizant moment by moment of our sensory experiences really, really seeing when we look at something, really hearing, then we're just using what is already there to bring ourselves to the point that we can experience who we already are. There's nothing lacking in any of us. It's all there. And it's simply how we've been trained over and over again that we aren't present. And that's the difference with Dharma, with Buddhism, versus...
Yeah, I see that. That's one of the reasons why I'm really, I resonate to the Dharma.
I mean, I came into Dharma because a therapist in the mid-70s, who was a Tibetan practitioner, said, "It's not you who's wrong, it's how you're perceiving that's wrong." And somehow that, if I was wrong, I knew nothing about Buddhism then there's nothing, because I had been told that ever since I had been born. My dad said, "You've been in trouble ever since you've been born, and I wish you had never been born." And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. There was something wrong with me. And then Eric said that one phrase, and it was like a light went on, because if it was how I was perceiving, I could shift that. That could be changed. I mean, we all come to it differently. But if we keep with that hope, that knowing, allowing for the possibility that it really is all here, that we couldn't have the aspirations we have if it wasn't already who we are, then we cannot access, experience, manifest the full potential of our being anyplace else but in this moment right here and now. And I'm not saying do what I say, but what feels right to you, to put yourself in a place where the experience of your authentic self can arise. For some people, it might be playing music. I mean, or dance. One of my students is living next door to me now, and she's a jazz musician, and she struggled all these years with an understanding of true nature of mind. And finally I said, "What about when you're doing jazz riffs? What are you feeling?" And she said, Well, it's just the music comes on its own. I just feel wide open. It's just, I said, that's true nature of mind. Oh. It's not something out there. One of my brothers, it was like a master woodworker, carpenter. And that's how he expressed himself. He had to be very present. He had to learn to measure twice. It cost a lot of money if he didn't. He had to learn to be present. And now we, for us who have chosen to follow the Dharma, what happens when we follow the Dharma? When we make a commitment to ourselves, to all sentient beings, we're stirring the pot of what is stuck inside of us, the wrong concepts. And what is the teacher's job? To stir the pot. It's an act of compassion. When I finally began to learn not to defend myself, I had started, well, it still is, a center in Rochester, New York in 82. They had, you know, the whole board of directors and all of this, and place where everybody met. And when Ayin Rinpoche set up the mechanics of it, I was the teacher, even though I was still stuttering at that time. And I didn't have a vote on the board, but I had veto power on the board. Can you imagine being set up that way? And of course, in any group, dissension arose. So then the next time Rinpoche came, people were complaining about me, and I was inexperienced. And I, since I had stuttered so badly, I didn't learn social niceties as I was growing up because I didn't interact. And so one day, I was feeding him and doing everything, but one day he said to me, after I finish teaching this evening, I want you to address the group. And I said, what do you want me to say? And he said, I won't tell you what to say, but I'll tell you how to start. And he said, this is how you'll start. Due to my obscurations, problems came and grew. Whoa. So that night he finished teaching. He's, you know, up here and I'm sitting down here. And I said, Rinpoche, can I say a few words to the group? You want to say something? And so I started, due to my obscurations. somehow my stuttering was gone. And I started talking about Sangha and what it really meant. I must have talked for 45 minutes. The words just flowed out of me. And then pretty soon people started saying, well, this isn't all Ani's fault. But by him telling me to do that, and by my willingness to do it, it cut through all the problems that had arisen, and communication was able to start again. And Mark, who was one of his students, told me the next day, he said, you should have seen Rinpoche's face when you were talking. He just had a huge smile on his face. But when I was finished and we were going up the stairs, I said, Rinpoche, is what I said okay? Yeah, it was okay. We have to learn not to protect the ego. Protect who we are, who we think we are. And how wonderful for those people who they hear the teaching and they just get it. But I guarantee you, in previous lives, they went through all the poking and prodding too.
You know, in response to your question about the coaches, you know, I was never an athletic person, so I never had that sort of feeling. But one thing Ani said last night that I've been thinking about is she urged us to act. It's the word she used, not react. And so I don't know if that helps to frame it. And it begs the question of, well, what's the difference, or how do we know when we're acting versus reacting? And I was thinking of that coach, and I was thinking, you know, I'm imagining some like soft kid t-ball coach, you know, softball coach, something like that. And I'm thinking, okay, that poor coach is reacting to the way his coach taught him, you know.
And what the expectations are about what he should do.
Yeah.
And if you, as a kid or whatever, could have the insight that maybe he's reacting, and that you now have the chance to sort of break that cycle by not reacting to his reaction, you know, then maybe, you know, he'll sort of work through that obscuration at some point. And I think it's really tough to, you know, I can see sort of two opposites, one of which I like better. You know, one is this idea that you always get the teacher that you need at that moment, you know, and the person who is the one who gets most under your skin, as a coworker or family member or whatever, is the one who has the most to teach you at that time, because, I mean, it's the biggest opportunity to learn right then. And that seems to sort of cultivate honoring that person instead of disrespecting him, that you acknowledge them. But the sort of darker side of that that I, you know, would want to steer away from would be this judgmental thing about other people, to say, oh, you're just reacting to your own, you know, I'm so much better because I have insight and I'm mindful and you're not, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I guess, you know, each of those is part of the interaction with somebody who's, you know, not using skillful means. And the teacher who is the most skilled, I suppose, could see in each individual student, mm-hmm. at each individual moment, what kind of teaching that student would best thrive on from that moment. But this idea of, you know, when you talked about other religions, there are all these lists of things you should do, and to me, it could all be subsumed under what you said about if we act, which implies present moment awareness, as opposed to react, which
is
implies
blind.
More this fusion of the past or confusing this relationship with that old bad coach relationship, you know, that kind of thing, that, you know, maybe you have a better chance of doing a better thing. Or growing from a less than optimal experience.
Thank you all for being responsive.
Well, that's, I think that your question is really sort of the nub of
the
retreat. Because that, you know, that's, I mean, that's Dharma in everyday life, and that's what the retreat is about. It's this 23 hours off the cushion, you know, when we're in fact dealing with coaches or, you know,
bosses.
And please understand that I get it. I know that the moments, that those peak moments have often happened when I can go back 40 years and remember being at a Trappist monastery where Thomas Merton had been, being in silence, walking through the fields and boom. Mm-hmm. And so I know that there's something about where I was, how I was in that moment, all of those dynamics, the silence and everything else that caused that. And so, sure, I want to do more of that. I want to be set up. That's, you know, I want to be in that, whether it's meditating or silence, I want to.
Or living your life.
Yeah. It's still that, you know. Why should I have to be like that? If this is the true nature of myself, why should I have to be in these, you know? And I think I'm getting it, but because it's kind of like it works.
Yeah.
Stuff works. And leave it at that. You know, just leave it at that. It works. So,
because that awareness, that moment of grace, whatever you want to call it, it can pop up at the oddest times. When I was at the center in Rochester. I was working as a home health aide just so I would have some money and I could also get back to India. And during an ice storm one winter, I had clients who I went to their homes, and I didn't know if the buses were running, the sidewalks were 2 inches thick and this clear. And I had to walk 2 or 3 blocks to where the road was, where I would catch a bus, and getting there, it's like, you really had to be aware of where you were placing your feet and keep rebalancing. And I think getting from the center to the bus, I was forced to be present. And the bus actually came, and when I climbed up on the bus and I sat down and I let out a sigh of relief, it was one of the loveliest peak experiences I had ever had. Soft, clear. What distinguishes a peak experience is you feel absolutely clear. There's such clarity. There's a joy that's bubbling up. Not joyful in response to something. It's like a bubbling up inside. And there's a feeling of such peace. Why? Oh, yeah.
Could I ask about that very thing? Because it came up yesterday too, when you mentioned the bubbling up of joy, and not excuse me, coming from it. Let me say it again: the bubbling up of joy, and it coming from inside us,
not dependent on something outside.
And I wanted to understand that, or you know, hear it again, or you know, somehow in order to understand it. Because what happened for me was that yesterday when I called to say I was going to be late, and I talked to Jan, and he said, and I said, I'm coming, I'll be there in 20 minutes. He said, that'll be perfect. And I felt such a big bubbling up of joy, which I was really aware of because I had been feeling such a lack of bubbling up of joy. And so was that in reaction, or I mean,
it felt so
authentically from
myself. Because whatever tension or what you were holding on, and your, I would think that there was upset about being late, just by how he said it too. That's absolutely perfect. Just everything lifted, and the bubbling up that was already there, but being held down by your mind, was free to flow.
Yeah, it felt like so much love.
Yeah. There's no difference. It's like Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. They sound like separate things, but there's really no division at all. Like Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya. But what's and then there's Svabhavakaya, which is the non-duality of all three. So it's kind of like this explanation, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or the three bodies of enlightenment that are actually one, is an attempt that the Tibetans made to explain pure awareness, explain the process of enlightenment or what, to a mind, a relative mind that hasn't had the experience, to give them some point to strive towards. Remember, when the Buddha became enlightened and realized nature of mind, he did not want to teach because he did not think anybody could understand. And we have all these books out there who every teacher is saying the same thing from a slightly different angle, who in one book someone may have an aha moment with that direction, and then there's another book. And when we have an aha moment, because that's really it, you read it and it, I think, this is me, I think those aha moments are the coming to conscious awareness of what we already knew. Because it's not really something you can grab hold of and hold on to, but there's some sort of a knowing.